And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And we're going to get off into our commentary tonight. Our commentary tonight is by Oak, who contributes commentaries on a regular basis. This is one of his archived commentaries called Snowmobiles.
Snowmobiles. If I were living deep in the wilds of Hudson's Bay or some such place, it might make sense for me to utilize a snowmobile for long-distance treks. I mean, snowshoes only go so far. But down here in the lower 48, with what seems like a Burger King on every other corner, snowmobiles seem pretty much out of place. Admit it. Most people use these contraptions for thrills. I say the cost to the biosphere is way too high. An extreme example of a sport run amok was revealed when the highest levels of carbon monoxide ever recorded in the nation were discovered a few winters ago at the west entrance of Yellowstone Park. It's been reported that every weekend during the winter, snowmobiles around Old Faithful cause as much air pollution as cars do all year throughout the park. I read recently that there are 2.5 million of these things in use today, and that sales have doubled in the last 5 years. Given that snowmobiles discharge about a third of their fuel unburned onto the snow or into the atmosphere, and that they create havoc for all sorts of wildlife, what are these people thinking? Snowmobiling isn't a sport. It's a recreational assault. The good news is that many national parks are now considering restrictions on snowmobile use. About 60 environmental groups have petitioned the National Park Service to outright ban the use within park boundaries. If you want to add your voice to the growing opposition to snowmobiles, check out the Blue Water Network website at www.earthisland.org/BW, or call Blue Water at 415-788-3666. Also, check in with local or regional enviro groups to see if similar efforts are being made with regard to state and county land. Until snowmobile manufacturers can come up with some kind of sensible machine, they're destined to meet with resistance. For the most part, snowmobiles as we know them don't make a whole lot of sense. Anyway, that's the view from this oak for Earth First Radio.
And some of you may say, well, weren't snowmobile banned in Yellowstone National Park? And in fact, under the Clinton administration, they were. However, the reason I played this commentary tonight was that a group of snowmobile manufacturers have sued the federal government to get snowmobiles allowed back into Yellowstone National Park. And in fact, the National Park Service is currently holding hearings to that effect. And now for some upcoming events. Earthfilms.org presents a special sneak screening of Treesit, The Art of Resistance. And this film is by James Ficklin and the Headwaters Action Video Collective. It'll be on Thursday, November 29th at 7 p.m. at Cell Space, the address 2050 Bryant Street in San Francisco. Come see the amazing new feature documentary about the grassroots environmental movement. This film covers over 10 years of civil disobedience and direct actions to save the last remnant of ancient temperate rainforest in California. Here's the inside story that sets the context for this modern-day myth. From the struggle to save Headwaters Forest to the assassination attempt of Judy Berry to the pepper spray torture of young activists to the establishment of the permanent tree villages and the marathon tree sits of Julia Butterfly Hill, Nate Madsen, and others. A cinematic whirlwind of action mixed with poignant commentary, biting political analysis, beautiful nature footage, all mixed to a hypnotic cutting-edge soundtrack of drum and bass electronica and tribal pagan folk music. This film is historically relevant, exhilarating, informative, and intense. Treesit is much more than just a hippie tree-sitter film. It includes big-picture issues such as Native American struggles, political prisoners, our spiritual connection to nature, deep ecology, police brutality, government corruption, big labor joining forces with environmentalists to oppose corporate rule, and the birth of the anti-globalization movement at the WTO protests in Seattle.
The film features Joan Baez, Bonnie Raitt, Woody Harrelson, and Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead. After the film, there'll be a question and answer session with filmmaker James Ficklin. The evening will end with live music performed by members of Land of the Blind, who are featured in the soundtrack. Howard Zinn describes Treesit as truly inspiring, and it was last year's winner of Earth Vision's Film Festival Award for the Best Forest Documentary. Once again, that's Thursday, November 29th at 7 p.m. at Cell Space, 2050 Bryant Street in San Francisco. If you'd like more information, contact Earth Films, their number, 415-820-1635. That's 415-820-1635. Or visit their webpage at www.treesit.org. That's www.treesit.org. And coming up in January is Earth Activist Training, January 4th through the 18th with Starhawk and Penny Livingston Stark. Learn how to create the world you want to live in. This is a permaculture design course for visionary activists. Learn the skills to transform a piece of land, a community, and our political and economic systems. The tools we need to envision and design a just, free, and sustainable culture are the same ones we need to challenge the vested interests that keep destructive systems in place. Permaculture is a system of ecological design. You will spend 2 weeks in the coastal California hills learning nature and wilderness awareness, diversity in ecosystems and our movement, pattern thinking and design strategy and movement building, solutions that exist like alternative energy, organic farming and natural building, bioremediation and restoration, soil and forest ecology and ecological economics, how to collect, conserve, and clean water, movement building, strategy and direct action principles and practices, consensus process, facilitation and conflict transformation, how to transform fear, rage, grief, and frustration into creative action, how to stay grounded and centered in tough and challenging situations, how to create ritual and weave magic into action, and much more. This program leads to a certificate in permaculture design. The core facilitators are Starhawk, who is a lifelong activist, direct action trainer, ecofeminist, and author of many books that link earth-based spirituality with political struggle, including Spiral Dance, The Fifth Sacred Thing, and The 12 Wild Swans, A Journey into the Realm of Magic, Healing, and Action. Penny Livingston Stark is an internationally recognized, prominent permaculture teacher and designer. Penny specializes in creating resource-rich landscapes, non-toxic building materials, site planning and design using ecologically sound principles and methods. Once again, this is taking place January 4th through the 18th in western Sonoma County in California. The real cost of this program is between $9 and $1,500 sliding scale. Some work trades and payment plans are available. We are actively fundraising to provide scholarships to activists and people who serve low-income communities. To apply or for more information, contact Capra Geneva, that's CapraJNEVA, P.O. Box 341, Point Reyes Station, California, 94956. Once again, that address, Capra Geneva, P.O. Box 341, Point Reyes Station, California, 94956, and the phone number 415-663-9090. That's 415-663-9090. And here's a story about salmon by Kate Lazaroff entitled Salmon Feed Forests and Forests Shelter Salmon. Salmon in the rivers of the Pacific Northwest nourish and sustain the forests through which they travel, suggests new research. A report issued recently argues that efforts to protect Pacific salmon need to include comprehensive tactics focused not only on the fish, but on their larger ecosystem. The study by scientists James Helfield and Robert Naiman of the University of Washington shows that the health of salmon populations both depends on and influences the vitality of the land-based ecosystems like forests. Their research calls into question traditional single-species approaches to fisheries management, endangered species legislation, and ecological restoration. The findings come at a time when Pacific salmon have disappeared from or are in serious decline throughout most of their historical spawning range in Northern America. Salmon benefit from the plants that line the banks of their spawning grounds. These trees and bushes, known as riparian vegetation for their proximity to the river's natural banks, provide many of the conditions that salmon need for successful spawning. The riparian plants provide shade, which helps regulate the temperature of the spawning grounds. Trees and large bushes provide snags and other debris, which creates sheltered areas along the river in which young salmon can find refuge and also help keep river sediments in place, reducing erosion. Without healthy riverbank ecosystems, an otherwise clean and healthy river may not be able to support a viable salmon population, the researchers found. But the researchers also learned that salmon give back just as much to the riparian plants. Salmon die shortly after they have spawned, adding vital nutrients to the water and nearby ecosystems. Hellfield and Naaman compared the amount of nitrogen in riparian vegetation near spawning sites with sites without salmon along two rivers on Chigakoff Island in southeast Alaska. They found that plants in spawning sites contained a higher level of nitrogen, an important nutrient, than did their reference counterparts. The differences between the spawning sites and non-spawning sites were significant in all plant species studied, except for the red alder, a tree species that gets most of its nitrogen from the air. This study allows ecologists to see that the relationship between riparian vegetation and salmon is a two-way street, Naaman says. As a main limiting factor for terrestrial plant growth in many northern and temperate forests, nitrogen is of vital importance to plants, and the nitrogen derived from spawning salmon is an essential addition to the ecosystem. The presence of salmon may explain why trees in the riparian zone are often larger than trees farther away from the riverbed. For example, in Hellfield and Naaman's study, the growth rates of Sitka spruce trees located near spawning sites were more than triple that of sites with no salmon. This means that the large woody debris that protects young salmon in streams and rivers can be produced in less than a century along salmon rivers. Along rivers without salmon, it can take more than three centuries for trees to grow trunks and branches large enough to shelter salmon. Because of the mutually dependent relationship between salmon and riparian vegetation, a decline in salmon could cause changes in the forest. These changes may in turn harm the salmon, speeding up their decline. Hellfield and Naaman say that scientists and policymakers are working to ensure that healthy salmon population must be aware of these relationships. The traditional approach of focusing on just getting more salmon into the rivers is not going to work. We have to devise more innovative ways to ensure the viability of riparian and river ecosystems, said Hellfield and Naaman. This study is a clear demonstration of the complex series of interactions that take place within any ecosystem, and we must be mindful of not upsetting these exchanges through our restoration efforts. Already, controversy on the best way to protect wild salmon has led to a landmark court decision overturning federal protections for salmon in coastal Pacific areas. Earlier this year, a federal judge in Eugene, Oregon, ruled that there is no evidence that wild coho salmon are genetically distinct from hatchery-raised coho and reversed a decision listing the coho as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The ruling could spell the end of federal protections for a dozen salmon species across the country and remove federal requirements for the critical salmon habitat, including riparian riverbank vegetation, be conserved or restored. The University of Washington report appears in the September issue of the journal Ecology. 11.2 miles of the Kootenay River in Idaho have been protected for white sturgeon. In keeping with an agreement with the Center for Biological Diversity, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has designated 11.2 miles of the Kootenai River in Idaho as critical habitat for the Kootenai River white sturgeon on September 6th. The white sturgeon is a very large, long-lived fish which has thrived in the Kootenai River for tens of thousands of years. It stopped reproducing when Libby Dam altered the flooding patterns, streambed conditions, and water temperatures necessary for sturgeon to reproduce. If Libby Dam is not removed or modified, the sturgeon will eventually go extinct due to old age. Virtually all remaining fish are at least 26 years old, exactly correlating with the construction of the dam in 1975. The Army Corps of Engineers manages the dam, but routinely flouts required sturgeon conservation measures and is thus headed for a legal showdown with the center later this year. In 1995, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service concluded that Libby Dam was driving the sturgeon extinct and demanded that the Corps release greater amounts of water during the spring spawning season. The Corps ignored the requirement. In December of 2000, the service again concluded that the dam was jeopardizing the fish and again required higher spring flood levels be maintained. Yet the Corps refused to implement the mandatory conservation measures again this year. The Kootenai River white sturgeon was listed as an endangered species in 1994. A recovery plan was created for it in 1999. It will be extinct in your lifetime if the Army Corps of Engineers continues to ignore its legal and ethical responsibilities to restore natural flooding patterns to the Kootenai River. Also threatened by Libby Dam is the Kootenai River burbot, West Slope cutthroat trout, bull trout, and kokanee salmon. American Wildlands petitioned to list the Berbat as endangered in 2000 as part of a nationwide agreement with the center to issue 29 listing decisions. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife will soon issue an initial decision on federal protection for the Berbat. If you'd like more information, visit the Biological Diversity website at www.biologicaldiversity.org. That's www.biologicaldiversity, all one word, .org. They have lots of information on lots of things there. And invasive Argentine ants harm ecosystems. The tiny black Argentine ant, a well-known household pest, may be disrupting natural ecosystems by replacing native ants, a new report reveals. A study by a University of California Davis graduate student published in the journal Nature has for the first time shown that when key beneficial species are removed by an invader, the destructive effects can reverberate through the ecosystem. Carolyn Christian, a student at the UC Davis Center for Population Biology, studied the Finbo shrublands of South Africa, an area similar in climate and vegetation to the chaparral of California. The Finbos is renowned worldwide for its high level of biodiversity. Wildfires sweep through the Finbos every 15 to 30 years, killing most mature plants. New plants grow from seeds buried in the ground by native ants. Christian found that when the Argentine ants displace native ants, plants that depend on those ants to bury their seeds do not regenerate after fire. There's been a lot of concern that invasive species may disrupt mutually beneficial interactions between plants and animals, said Maureen Stanton, a professor of ecology and evolution at UC Davis and Christian's thesis supervisor. If these interactions are crucial, there might be cascading effects on the whole community, Stanton added. Seed burial by ants is key to survival for about a third of Finbo's plant species, Christian said. When fresh seeds fall, ants are attracted to them and carry them off to bury in their nests. Different ant species specialize in seeds of different sizes. Ants that work together deal with bigger seeds, while ants that tend to work alone bury smaller ones. If the seeds are not picked up, almost all are eaten by rodents. Argentine ants do not bury seeds at all, but they do wipe out two Finbos ant species that prefer large seeds. Two other ant species that coexist with the invader go for smaller seeds. Large seeds placed in areas invaded by Argentine ants were less likely to be buried by the ants and more likely to be eaten by rodents compared to large seeds in uninvaded areas, Christian found. Small seeds were much less affected. After experimental burning, invaded areas showed a tenfold drop in the number of new plants from large-seeded species compared to uninvaded areas. It's sobering and a wake-up call, said Stanton. The study showed the threat from invasive species both to the Finbos and to ecosystems in general, she said, and we thank the Environment News Service. Ship and fast ferry collisions are killing whales. Around the world, ships and ferries are striking whales and causing the needless and bloody deaths of alarming numbers of them, many among them young whales and newborn calves. The death toll is projected to rise with the expansion of global shipping, ocean cruising, and fast ferry systems. As part of our Clean Vessels campaign, Blue Water Network is advocating for slower vessel speeds and special routing in whale habitat, low-draft vessel designs, and onboard sonar technology for locating whales. Cruise ships are killing whales in many corners of the world, from Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska and British Columbia to the Caribbean and Mediterranean. Fast ferries are running down more and more whales as waterways are transformed into marine highways for commuter traffic, recreational travel, and cargo delivery. The highly endangered northern right whale may disappear forever due to the intrusion of cargo ships and tankers into the critical breeding and calving grounds along the east coast of the U.S. Two calves were run over this year alone. The numbers of fin whales, humpback whales, and gray whales are also being reduced by shipping traffic collisions. Take action. To help the Blue Water Network lead the effort to make busy waterways safe for whales, we are calling on you to assist in the collecting of information about whale strikes. Find out about more whales, about their habitats and their migration patterns. Let us know if you witness any type of vessel collide with a whale. Provide as many details of the collision as possible, including when, where, the type and name of the vessel, type of the whale, the circumstances, and any injuries to passengers. Any photos of ship whale strikes would be welcome. Send us copies of articles that document ship whale strikes. Alert us to any television or radio news about ship whale strikes, including what channel and when it aired. Send any comments or ship whale strike reports to Terry Shore, T. Shore, That's T-S-H-O-R-E at earthisland.org. That's T-Shore at earthisland.org. When the time is right, we will also call on you to let your public officials know that whales should not die needlessly in the name of luxury cruising, the expansion of global shipping, or faster ferries. The Blue Water Network is a project of Earth Island Institute. 8 elephants have been found dead in India's Assam state. Indian forest guards have found the bodies of 8 elephants in the country's northeastern state of Assam, and officials have said angry villagers are suspected of poisoning them. Forestry Department official R.K. Dawes told Reuters villagers harassed by raids on their farms by wild elephants looking for food had probably killed the elephants by spraying poison into their water and food sources. 8 carcasses of wild elephants have been found at 3 different locations near Tezpur in the past couple of days. All of them are believed to have died of poisoning, Dawes said. Tezpur lies about 110 miles north of the Assam state capital of Dispur. Growing human settlement in their habitats has forced herds of wild elephants out of the jungles to trample paddy fields, destroy houses and granaries, the officials said. Dawes said there could be more bodies of elephants in the area, and forest guards had launched searches. In the past 3 months, forest guards have found 22 dead elephants in the same area, including 18 of them in Namari National Park. Northeastern India is home to about half of India's elephant population of 30,000. Experts say government protection of elephants over the last 20 years, including a ban on their capture, had led to an increase in their population in the Assam state. And we thank Reuters News Service for that story. Bitterroot grizzly reintroduction plan gets a second look. Public comments on the United States Fish and Wildlife Service's proposal to cancel plans to reintroduce grizzly bears into the Bitterroot ecosystem in Montana and Idaho have led the agency to review its decision. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released a preliminary analysis of public comments received on its proposal to withdraw a decision to reintroduce grizzly bears into the Bitterroot and focus recovery efforts on the 5 existing populations in the lower United States. The proposal grew 8,222 comments from 50 states and 19 countries, the majority of which opposed the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposal. The agency will review the public comments and, in particular, evaluate any new biological information they may contain as part of the Department of Interior's final decision-making process on grizzly bear reintroduction. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced last June the proposal to focus recovery areas on the 1,100 grizzly bears in the lower 48 states, which are divided into 5 separate populations in Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and Washington. Under the proposal, biologists would continue actions to conserve and recover grizzly bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem, where a grizzly population of 400 to 600 bears is increasing by 2 to 4% each year, and in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem, where grizzly populations are stable or increasing and number 400 to 500 bears. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also would refocus recovery efforts and methods to preserve and increase populations in the Selkirk ecosystem, where there are 40 to 50 bears, the Cabinet Yaak ecosystem with 30 to 40 bears, and the Northern Cascade ecosystem, where there are about 5 bears. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruiseef at cruiseio.com. That's cruiseef at cruiseio.com, C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. Or send letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send all announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC and search for Earth First Radio and listen in. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so listen in anytime. You can always find Earth First Radio archived shows on the World Wide Web. There's a couple of locations. The first is www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net and www.la.indymedia.com. www.lamedia.org. That's www.la.indymedia.org, and search for Earth First Radio. This is show number 165. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis, and thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to Judy Berry singing about trying to get her fiddle back.
Well, I was driving out of Oakland on a tour for Redwood Summer when a bomb went off inside my car. It was a major bummer. They blamed me for the bomb that almost took my life. But there's one last thing that they did, one last twist of the knife. The FBI stole my fiddle.
They stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my
sing-along.
Fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. Next day in the papers, although it made no sense, was a picture of my fiddle, and they called it evidence. They took away my Birkenstocks, they took away my car. But when they took my fiddle, well, you know they went too far. The FBI stole my fiddle.
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 William Sessions stole my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. They said my strings was fuses, my bow it was a light. And down inside my fiddle hole I stashed my dynamite. So when I stroke my fuse strings with my fiddle bow, you better run for cover, cause this fiddle might just blow. The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle. J. Edgar Hoover stole my fiddle, and I want my fiddle back. Well, Special Agent Richard Held is the man behind the show. He helped frame Leonard Peltier and jail Geronimo. He falsified the evidence, life sentences, no bail. It's time to get them freed, and let's put Richard Held in jail. The FBI stole my fiddle.
Stole my fiddle.
Richard Held stole my fiddle.